May it please the court, counsel. I'm Shane Coleman. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Donald Stratton, in this matter. There are multiple issues on this appeal, although we believe there are substantial overlap among those issues. I'm going to address this in the same order that it's addressed in our briefs, which I think adequately cover pretty much everything in this case. I'm going to address Dr. Buck's, the claims against Dr. Buck first. I'm going to then proceed to the claims against Ms. Brown. And with the court's indulgence, I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
If you could look at the clock as well, I'll try to catch it, but thank you.
Thank you. The first issue we turn to is the most critical one, and the one I think is dispositive of this matter, and that's the RAND notice. I'm referring specifically to the granting of summary judgment in favor of Dr. Buck when I addressed RAND first. But the reason RAND is so important and the notice they're under is because there's no harmless error review under RAND. If the notice required by RAND was not given, this court doesn't look any further to guess what might Mr. Stratton have given to the trial court. It's remanded and it goes from there. We're not here to guess whether or not the error, if any, was harmless. And we're not here to guess what he might have submitted. The specific issue in this case, though, is whether a RAND notice can be buried in a scheduling order issued months prior to the summary judgment motion. RAND, the so-called RAND notice, as the court knows, actually derives from much earlier cases, and RAND is just probably the most recent en banc formulation of what that notice requires. But the gist of RAND says that we need to inform certain litigants, in this case pro se prisoner plaintiffs, of their rights as it relates to summary judgment. And specifically, what RAND stands for is the proposition that we need to level the playing field. The defendants in these cases are typically represented by counsel. And the defendants know that Rule 56 permits the submission of certain information to the court for consideration of summary judgment. Summary judgment, which many courts have referred to as an extreme remedy, because it takes out the case before the litigant ever has a chance to get to court. One of the cases that cited, I think, for another proposition refers to summary judgment as essentially a mini trial, in that the court is trying to determine, is trying to weigh whether or not this case even gets to trial. And from a plaintiff's, pro se prisoner plaintiff's perspective, it's a lot of P's. Yeah. It is the trial, essentially, if the case is going to get tossed. So the question is, when the court is about to consider matters beyond what is simply stated in the pleadings, when the court is about to consider facts, whether it considers those as either undisputed facts or whether it weighs those facts, the plaintiff, when that plaintiff is a pro se prisoner, is entitled to protections that might not otherwise apply. In RAND, there was a notice that was given that was actually fairly substantive, and it was too substantive because it cited the law. But in RAND, the defendants in that case, within their summary judgment briefing, included a notice that followed what was then the case referred to as Klingel, I believe is how it's pronounced, and said, here's the notice, here's what's going to happen on summary judgment. RAND said, We commend the efforts of the defendants, but by burying that notice within the pleadings, by including it as a part of it, it didn't fairly warn, and that's the language of RAND, is warning. It didn't fairly warn the pro se prisoner of exactly what could happen, because it didn't present itself in a way that, hey, heads up, your case could be dismissed, and here's what you can do, even though...
Does it make a difference?
Does
it make a difference in this case that the district judge took up the Rule 56F request and after the objections to the findings and recommendations by the magistrate judge, and both sides were given an opportunity to go over the discovery that was what you folks argue was answered in a tardy fashion, or the answers to interrogatories, and was able to weigh all of that information and provide the plaintiff prisoner pro se an opportunity to review and respond to that information?
No, it does not, Your Honor, and here's why it doesn't. There's more than just the conducting of discovery that Rand and the subsequent decision and Wyatt discuss. What it's about is leveling the playing field, not only to permit discovery of facts that could then be presented, but it would also afford Mr. Stratton, for instance, the opportunity to submit his own affidavit. And there are issues related, for instance, to exhaustion, where he has made assertions in his briefs, for instance, that he submitted a request that he believed, and I'm skipping ahead, I apologize, but he believed that the court was going to, or believed that the grievance officer was going to resubmit something. Mm-hmm. I don't see that in the record where he did that, but he said that in his briefs. So beyond just conducting discovery, beyond Rule 56F, I'm entitled to further discovery, he would also have the opportunity in responding to summary judgment to submit his own testimony, essentially. That's one point. Point two would be Rand is about notice. It's not about extending discovery necessarily. It's about informing the prisoner of what information, of how to go about dealing with summary judgment. And Rand has, Rand has said that it's not sufficient to give that notice when it's buried within a brief. In this case, for the exact same reason, it's not appropriate to give it in a form scheduling order sent out to the parties 2 months before any summary judgment brief issues. It's a poor example, but think about any other time in society when we give a warning. Rand talks about the beginning of the Rand notice that it attaches as Exhibit A. It refers to that as it says warning. The defendant has moved for summary judgment. In other words, it contemplates a contemporaneous notice being given. But any other time in society when we want to give notice, cigarettes are dangerous, where do we put that notice? We put it at the point of use. Where do we put traffic notices when we want to warn somebody of an upcoming merging into traffic, for instance? We teach them in driver's education, for sure. But we also, that doesn't mean we don't put signs on the road when there's about to be a dangerous situation. That's what happened here. If it was insufficient in Rand to include that notice within the briefs, it's even worse to include the Rand notice 2 months earlier.
Mr. Coleman, let me ask you a question. I think the point you made about plaintiff's inability to come up with his own affidavit with respect to the exhaustion as against the nurse, I think that has some validity that I can see. I'm having a hard time, putting my thinking cap on what additional fact has not been developed with respect to whether the doctor was a state actor. Can you help us there? It sounds like everything that we need to know is in the record.
Your Honor, and I hate to give you the cop-out answer, but the short answer is we don't consider harmless error review for failure to give a Rand notice.
Well, that's not exactly right. I mean, I look at Rand, and Rand said that harmless error is usually not appropriate. It doesn't say it's never appropriate. Isn't that right?
The discussion in Rand and in at least one of the other cases following Rand referencing this point still talks about a notice. They ran leaves open.
Well, I'm not saying he didn't get notice. We stipulate he didn't get the notice for the purposes of our argument. But Rand says we continue to believe that harmless error review is inappropriate in most cases. It doesn't say all the time. So let me get back to my question to you, which is there? Can you conjure up any fact? I read your brief where you discussed the state actor principles. Is there any fact that you can think of that wasn't developed that could have been?
I cannot, Your Honor. And in a normal situation where the record seems to me to be devoid of that, I would very sheepishly try to come up with a different answer. Here I proudly tell you, I can't think of what Mr. Stratton might have developed, either in discovery, further discovery had it been permitted, nor can I imagine what he might have submitted based on the information he already had. But that's the point. He should have had the opportunity, and Rand would have alerted him to that. I don't know what he would have done. It's not in the record. And one reason why I don't think it's in the record is because he wasn't given the Rand notice. Rand, to be clear, talks about it's not always harmless error review, but it refers to those instances of repeat litigants who have perhaps gotten the Rand notice in a related case previously. That's what it talks about as an exception to the harmless error review. It doesn't say we're going to look substantively at the underlying merits of this and conclude that the error was harmless because there were no set of facts that he could have developed had he been given the notice and had he been afforded the opportunity to conduct discovery. And since I'm running short of time, if I may, I want to skip to that point specifically as to Dr. Buck. The narrow inquiry here on the merits, and again, in reviewing a summary judgment grant, we're talking about whether there's any fact, material fact, that could have been developed, not what we believe those facts necessarily will ultimately come down to. The narrow issue is, should an ER physician be treated differently than another private physician? The West case tells us a couple of things from the Supreme Court. It tells us, first of all, we look at the function within the system. Well, first it tells us that a private physician can be found to be a state actor. Second, and in that case there was a contractual relationship that was relied upon. Secondly, it tells us that we don't look necessarily, though, at that relationship. We look at the function within the system. Medical care is a function that's being performed.
Well, doesn't West say that voluntariness is an important factor in determining this issue? And so, I mean, if that's what it says, what's your response to that?
That's a tough one. I won't kid you, Your Honor. It says voluntariness. I don't think it says it's an important factor is probably what it says. I don't think it says it's a requirement. I think that was a factor that was present in the facts of West. It doesn't say that it necessarily needs to be found. The facts of West also included a contract. That was what went into the voluntariness. Other circuits like the Fourth Circuit have said there's no requirement that you even have a contract. And the Fourth Circuit, for instance, leaves open specifically the question of an ER physician in the hypothetical. And to be clear, the two cases that Dr. Buck relies on in this the Coles case did not address this. It specifically says Coles does not challenge this in any event. At the conclusion, after finding that an ER physician is not a state actor, it ends with, and Coles didn't even raise this issue. It's dicta, the court shouldn't consider it. The other one is Sykes, and Sykes specifically references the fact that there was no contractual relationship, and that's what the magistrate in this case referenced. There's no contractual relationship. We're asking this court to go beyond that and follow the line of reasoning that's in the Connor versus Donnelly case and to extend that. Why should there be a voluntariness requirement? The question is whether an individual is performing a function that's traditionally performed exclusively by the state. It's the function that should matter. It doesn't matter whether the person wants to be a state actor or not. It's their role within the system, and that's what West said.
Do you want to reserve the
balance? I'll reserve the remainder. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Michelle Atkins for Julie Buck. As you know, Mr. Stratton brought this 1983 claim alleging that he was subjected to cruel and unusual punishment by Dr. Buck for her failure to provide him with pain medication following an assault in the jail. The court below us properly and reasonably so decided that there was no evidence to support the claim that Dr. Buck was a state actor, and I'm asking this court to affirm that decision, finding that there was no abuse of discretion in that process. Clearly, we are before this court with regard to Dr. Buck on the issue of whether emergency medicine amounts to a public function exclusively reserved to the state, and the answer is it absolutely does not, and there's no case law that says otherwise. Dr. Buck is a private physician who provides emergency medicine care to every patient who walks in her door, whether she wants to or not. She has no contractual relationship with the state. Emergency medicine is not a traditional or exclusive function of this state, And the courts have made that perfectly clear. And in fact, the court did say in Coles versus Eagle that, quote, emergency room medical treatment is not a traditional and exclusive function of government, end quote.
Ms. Atkins, let me ask you this. Suppose we agree with you on the merits, but we also agree with Mr. Coleman that the notice was defective. What then?
Well, I think that it is correct to consider what the result of that would be and what the notice that was to be provided to Mr. Stratton required. And the only issue, as I understand it, before the court right now is the timing of that notice. There hasn't been an argument that the notice itself was inadequate, and in fact, the notice that was provided outlined very clearly the rules that apply to summary judgment, the process, and the outcome should the plaintiff fail to provide
right.
adequate.
Yeah, suppose we find the timing was off.
Then I think that the case would have to be remanded, and what would happen would be a huge waste of resources because, as Judge Bryan correctly pointed out, there is no more relevant evidence to gather in this case. All of the evidence that goes to this issue of state action, color of state law, has already been produced. There can be no argument based on any evidence.
But I guess the question is, if the RAND notice was insufficient, is it end game at that point, or is it harmless error? Because we look at, I'm on your side in terms of, I don't know that there's any more relevant evidence that could be gathered with regard to whether or not she was a state actor, and I think that point has been acknowledged.
Yes, and I think as Judge Silverman pointed out, that the RAND case doesn't say that in all cases you have to consider it harmless error, that you can consider what difference did it make, and I think that this is exactly the case to do that, because we already have all of the evidence that anyone could ever gather, and so we would be going back merely for form versus substance, mm-hmm. just to say, okay, because the district court was wrong in their decision as to when to give the RAND notice, Dr. Buck should be prejudiced by her reliance on the district court's timing of that notice, even though we all know and counsel essentially acknowledges that there will be no more evidence to support a finding of state action in this case. So this shouldn't be a harmless error application at this time. This is the appropriate case to consider what difference did the timing of the notice make. And again, that is the only issue here. So what this court would have to do in saying that the RAND notice provided here was inadequate would say to Dr. Buck, you were wrong to rely on the district court when they decided to issue that notice when they did, and you were wrong to rely on it because the issue is only timing. And the RAND case, of course, the issue there was whether it was appropriate for counsel to give that notice rather than the district court, not whether it's appropriate for the district court to give the notice. That was assumed to be the case. And
I wanted to ask you, does Gray Harbor Community Hospital have any sort of contract with Stafford Creek Correction Center to be the exclusive provider for emergency treatment?
Not that I'm aware of, but I don't represent Gray's Harbor, and Dr. Buck was an independent contractor for that private hospital. I'm not aware of whether they have a contract.
If they did, so we found that out during discovery, if they did, does that make Dr. Buck's actions any less voluntary?
No, because she has an obligation as an emergency medicine physician to provide care to every patient who comes in the door, whether she wants to or not. So even though the hospital, which is a separate party, someone she has an independent contract with, even if they decided to contract with the state or with the Department of Corrections, she wouldn't have any choice to opt in or opt out of that, because as an emergency medicine provider, she would have to provide the care regardless of whether she wanted to subject herself to potential 1983 claims like this one. And as the court correctly pointed out, there is a voluntariness aspect of this that must be considered, as all of the courts have pointed out, including West, including Coles, including Connor, which is why should we subject a physician like Dr. Buck, who doesn't have a choice in the matter, who will treat Mr. Stratton as she does every single person who comes into that hospital, whether she wants to or not. And I also would point out on the discovery issue, since petitioner is now arguing that this should be a public function test that is applied, in a case like this, responses to discovery would never matter, because under the theory that they have proposed, under the public function test, emergency medicine is always a function exclusively reserved to the state. So discovery on the issue of the relationship between Dr. Buck and the hospital and the emergency and the Department of Corrections, or a similar set of circumstances involving different players, that evidence would be entirely irrelevant, because what this court would have to do is say that emergency medicine is always, regardless of the particular circumstances of the relationship, is always an exclusive function of the state. And clearly that is not true. There's no case that says it is. And in fact, the one case that has spoken to emergency medicine specifically has said there is no such relationship. Thank you. I'll waive the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Candy Dibble, and I represent Ms. Dale Brown in this matter. Your Honors, we would ask that the district court's decision be upheld regarding the dismissal against the claims against Ms. Brown, because Mr. Stratton failed to exhaust his administrative remedies as required under the Prison Litigation Reform Act. As noted in our brief, the Supreme Court found in Woodford versus Noe that the PLRA, or the requirements under the PLRA, must be upheld, and that an inmate must fully exhaust all administrative remedies available to him, and that those administrative remedies must be exhausted in a timely manner. What the Supreme Court in its decision also upheld was that the inmate must exhaust all administrative remedies, not just those that meet federal standards. In his briefing, Mr. Stratton basically points to this court's decision in Sapp versus Kimbrell in 2010 and basically argues that Mr. Stratton, in essence, had an exception to the exhaustion requirement as set forth under Woodford. And what Mr. Stratton argued under Sapp versus Kimbrell were that there were two exceptions that the court laid out. The first exception was that there was a two-prong test, and the two-prong test involved whether the offender's grievance would have, in essence, gone through all levels of the grievance process, but two, whether or not the institution or the individual improperly screened that grievance. The second exception that was brought forth in Sapp versus Kimbrell was whether or not the reasonable inmate or a reasonable person would believe that he has, in essence, exhausted all administrative remedies available to him. In this particular case, Mr. Stratton is not arguing that his grievance was improperly screened. There are standards that were set forth in the Department of Corrections Offender Grievance Program, as noted in Mr. Frederick's declaration at Supplemental Excerpt of Record 72. And in that Supplemental Excerpt of Record, or in that declaration, Mr. Frederick talks about and lays out the facts regarding the department's Offender Grievance Program and notes in there that when offenders include certain items in grievances, including grieving outside entities or citing to case law or RCW, that those items are deemed to be non-grievable. In this particular matter, what Mr. Stratton is basically arguing is that he fits under the second exception under Sapp versus Kimbrell in the fact that he reasonably believed, or he thought, that there were no administrative remedies available to him once his second grievance was screened. In this particular case, all the evidence before the court and even Mr. Stratton's own behavior bellies that argument. In the second grievance,
Ms. Dibble, do you agree? Excuse me, Ms. Dibble. Do you agree that there was no RAND warning with respect to Brown's motion to dismiss?
Our position is that in regards to a motion to dismiss, a RAND warning is not applicable. This court in Wyatt versus.
So I didn't ask you if it was applicable. I asked you if one was given.
We believe that the RAND notice that was given was provided in the court's scheduling order, and if the court finds that a RAND notice is necessary under an unenumerated Rule 12 motion to dismiss, that notice was adequate when it was provided by the court in its scheduling order.
Did the scheduling order reference motions for summary judgment or motions to dismiss? How was it phrased?
It referenced a deadline for dispositive motions. And that's where the RAND notice is included at, and that is included in the supplemental excerpt of record for Ms. Buck under pages 2 and 3.
Trying to find that here. I'm sorry, we'll go, oh, here it is. It looks like it's dealing with motion for summary judgment. The warnings references a motion for summary judgment.
We would argue
I'm referring
that
to line 12. It says, if a motion for summary judgment is filed, it's important for the opposing party to note the following. And then it looks like it's couched in terms of the motion for summary judgment.
In essence, what the scheduling order is and what it sets forth is the deadline for dispositive motions. In White versus
Turner. Right, that's the paragraph above that. It says motions should be filed on July 23rd, 2010. Then the next paragraph said if a motion for summary judgment is filed, then it goes through the warning. It doesn't seem to talk about the kind of motion you brought.
That's correct, Your Honor. Ms. Brown's motion was brought as an unenumerated Rule 12 motion for a motion to dismiss or failure to exhaust. And this court made the determination in Wyatt versus Terhune. What they did was they, in essence, split the argument in Wyatt. What the court did in Wyatt was indicate that for a motion for summary judgment, a RAND notice is, in essence, applicable. What they also said in Wyatt was that for a motion to dismiss based on failure to exhaust, that was specifically not considered a motion for summary judgment, that was going to be considered a unenumerated Rule 12 motion. And what the court declined to do in White versus Terhune was basically, in essence, indicate that the requirements set forth in RAND were also to be provided to the offender in regards to a motion to dismiss under an unenumerated Rule 12 case. Assuming arguendo that notice be provided or that type of notice be provided to the offender, he was on notice, in essence, when he was required to set forth the facts in his complaint. In his complaint and in the court standard boilerplate form for a 1983 claim, one of the questions on there, in which he also included in his complaint, was the exhaustion requirement. He was well aware at the time that he filed his complaint that he was required to exhaust his administrative remedies, and if he failed to do that his case would be dismissed. In his complaint, he indicated that he, in fact, fully exhausted his administrative remedies. He was then placed on notice through Ms. Brown's answer in this case when she brought it up as an affirmative defense and indicated that he had failed to exhaust his administrative remedies. And therefore, both of those, not only through his pleading and through the court's, in essence, boilerplate form for a 1983 claim, but also in Ms. Brown's response or her answer to his complaint, he's placed on notice at both of those times that this is an issue, that he's required to exhaust his administrative remedies, and if he fails to do that, his case will be dismissed. Your Honor, therefore, we would ask that the decision of the court be upheld, that the case against Ms. Brown be dismissed for Mr. Stratton's failure to exhaust his administrative remedies. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very
thank
much.
You.
Mr. Coleman, I'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. And allow me to address these in reverse order, addressing the most recent arguments of Ms. Brown first. Wyatt is absolutely clear, we believe, that RAND notice is required. I don't think that's beyond an argument. And the notion that it wasn't required here because Mr. Stratton was required to set forth facts in his complaint is incorrect. Had this been a Rule 12b-6 motion or a Rule 12c motion where all we're looking at is the confines of the four corners of the complaint and the pleadings, I wouldn't be here making this argument. I'd be making a different argument probably. But we're not. The point of RAND is anytime we go beyond the text of the complaint, the face of the complaint and the answer, we need to give the prisoner notice of exactly what sorts of stuff can be considered. Mm-hmm. Turning back to Dr. Buck's arguments then. First, again, I'd reiterate that it's not our role, should not be this court's role, to decide what kind of evidence Mr. Stratton might present on remand if it's remanded under RAND. If he can't produce anything, then the district court will take care of it at that point. And secondly, this notion we also believe is correct that that Dr. Buck had no choice in the matter as to whether or not she treated him is the wrong inquiry. The inquiry under RAND, under West, is the function in the system, and we can't. I think it would be improper to say that treatment of a certain type in an ER is not state action or is not a state actor doing that on one day, but that same treatment in a different setting would be. The question of voluntariness should be the voluntariness of the pro se prisoner. It's that prisoner, that's the reason for the state actor notion, is the prisoner has no choice whether to get taken to the ER. He's confined, the state's making a choice for him of how he's going to get care, and the state has made that choice, in this case taking it to Dr. Buck. In conclusion, I guess I would ask this court to make this decision in this case, as it does, I think, in all cases, on the most basic and fundamental issue, without reaching issues that we need not get to. The most basic and fundamental issue as to both Dr. Buck and Ms. Brown's claims is the RAND notice. It's required for both of them. It's not just a matter of the timing of it. It's substantively flawed because the timing is intricately intertwined with what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to be a warning to say, this has happened, here's how you can respond if you have the goods, if you will. Thank you. That wasn't given, it's reversible error.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you all for your arguments here today. The case is now submitted and the court is in recess. Thank you again.